These studies are interesting for me because you know that most of these studies are never taught before, and they are sort of the whole package is sort of something that's made up as I go. And you learn things as you go, and you wonder whether I should have said that sooner or wait till later. Can't do that. But so anyway, I get somewhat kind of feeling funny about all this because usually you have a class laid out and you start from lesson one, you move through it systematically. So I'm saying all that, hope that what I do for you makes sense, because in a sense, it just makes sense to me. And so I'm learning the stuff, and sometimes I'll learn things later that I might have known earlier, I might have said then. But anyway, I've enjoyed the study very much. I'm going to be glad it's over because it's been a hard study, but it's been a very profitable study too. One of the thoughts I had this week, reflecting on our, how many weeks has it been now? This is 21, is sometimes you stir to the nest a little bit with ideas, and people go out and do silly things with ideas I give them. I don't want them to do that because we're not political. Don't want you to jump to any conclusions. So I have a little section in our lesson today to tell you how I've thought through this. And I'm going to call it kind of, I'm giving you tools to think with. And the tools you think with then are for you to decide what has happened in history, how the things we've talked about would have been different if would have been some of these principles would have been observed. So I'm not a problem solver for the history, and I'm going to talk about this in the class here, but I'd say it here in front. We're not problem solving history. I want you to be able to take a newspaper article and read it and understand it. I don't stand here with solutions to the problems even our country faces. I don't want to say it's beyond our help. It is, but it's not beyond the Lord's help, and it's not in our hands to change it. So again, I will give you a little bit of help here so that we have a little bit of a track to run on as we think about what we learned during these weeks, especially these last weeks. From Christmas on, they've been more into the actual economics of wonderfully made. It is a marvel to see how the world functions with the drag of sin on it. And it will not always function quite as harmoniously as it does now, because the Lord will come someday and remove the church from this age. We are the members of the church, and in us resides the Holy Spirit, and in us is that element we'll talk about again in a minute, an element in us that's somehow unexplainable, that works as preservative in society and light in society. I cannot explain that, but it is a wonderful thing to see how that the world does not run off its axis with the pressures that are on everything in the world from the satanic forces. So we just kind of hang on like roller coaster riders with white knuckles sometimes, knowing that the Lord is up front steering. You don't steer roller coasters, do you? Not a good metaphor. There we go. Tools. Useful tools in the analysis of life. Our class is meant to bring understanding. All right. I say this because some of you ask me questions about historical things. I don't know. So I don't want you to expect me to, decipher history. So we cannot decipher all history by using Bible economics. I think it's possible, but I'm not sure I have the tools to do that or the information about it. We can make our own attempts, however. The Bible gives us tools that we need with which to think, evaluate, and decide what is right and wrong. Certainly, this must include the economic structures. We shouldn't be ignorant people. Don't need to be ignorant people. As Christ followers, we call them Christians, we are not organizing ourselves as change agents or community organizers. We are not waiting for a Christian movement, for the Christian movement to be strong enough to shape public policies. We do not campaign, demonstrate, or protest evil practices. We are not in politics, which pits man against man. And actually, I think politics pits man against God. But we are, in biblical metaphors, salt and light. And I thought about this. Why did the Lord pick these two metaphors? Have you ever seen any salt crystals organize themselves? You know, two of them get together and all of a sudden they're lined up in rows and grids and patterns. No, they're just there, aren't they? They seem like they're unattached particles. But in food, they are unattached particles. They do their job wherever they find themselves. So we have no organization in salt. Now, am I pushing the metaphor a little too far? Well, no, I don't think so, because that is the metaphor that Jesus used about us. We are salt. And the same thing can be true for light. Now, we might say that light has an organizing principle because it has a source. But once it leaves the source, it just falls on everything. It just falls on everything. There's no organization to it. So we are in biblical metaphors, light and salt. Matthew 5:13 and so on. We are not organized. And I say we're not organized. The footnote is that the church is organized internally, but it's not organized as a force in the world. So we're not organized as a cultural force, but each is fulfilling the work of preserving society and shedding light into the dark from our own addresses. I mean, from where we live or work or buy gas. These are amazing truths, this salt laying around, that our feeble presence, 2 Corinthians, Paul calls it vessels of clay, on earth, the children of God, has such a profound dampening effect on the evil in the earth. The Holy Spirit is that restrainer in some way. I cannot explain it, but we know it's there. Okay, now we have explained why the world is the way it is by recognizing these five global events, creation, that's how we got here, the falls, where the evil started. The world became hostile with the expulsion and more hostile by exponentially at the flood and then again at language divisions. Those are the four things that explain how the world is today. We have noted that the world is not a safe place. Bad things happen. The four judgments of God are equally applicable to all people, it would appear. That puts us in an environment of evil, harmful, shameful, unequal trials. Things that are good and bad are going to happen to all individuals, more or less. Human beings, on the other hand, are uniquely gifted by God with various opportunities. This is the believer and unbeliever. With various opportunities and various outcomes. None of them are equal or the same, and we appreciate that. One of each of us is enough. Isn't that how you say that? And then we have any attempt to disregard these realities, and we talk a lot about equality today in the university. Somehow they think that's where it starts, I guess. Any attempt to disregard these realities will only greatly add to the despair of human existence, no matter how well-intentioned. Politicians mostly oppose the mandate. May promise a better tomorrow or relief from God's judgment, but they are incapable of eliminating it or even altering its course. So trying to eliminate inequity and poverty, trying to do that, they pile on new levels of misery as poverty is exasperated and wretchedness increases regardless of all the wealth spent to alleviate it. So we would call that in our parlance of last week would be a lose-lose situation. Now, another way, I'll do a little bit of time on this, which is kind of where we're going there. Another way of looking at what is, not just by the judgments or the curses. Another way to look at it is we have two world views, basically. We have the Christian worldview, which is unique in holding to a creator God who has made and owns everything. That was our early this season's lesson. This ideal is opposed by other religions. All other religions in some form or another. We just have two kinds, you know, one that accepts the Creator God or one that rejects Him. Now, these other religions all postulate some natural unknown developmental process that explains what is. They say the Big Bang is how we got here, but we don't know who started the Big Bang or where the material came to make the Big Bang. And then we have just this added idea of progressive evolution supposedly covers it all. But when they do that, they forgot to say, well, why is it here? Well, we forgot about that. Well, we don't know. But someday we'll figure it out. These two views, why things are the way they are, that is what is, sets up this conflict of the ages. Now, what is at stake? I would say what is at stake is the created world. I personally do not believe that the created world will ever be destroyed in the sense that it is not longer in existence. I think God created it and he owns it. And any giving up of what he created is a victory for Satan, which I don't think he can allow. So I think the world will be his in the end. And what he put on the earth will also be his at the end. And the crowning object of his creation is the man, man, capital M, that he put there. And thus, man and his habitat will be an object of the destruction of Satan, because that is where he went when he fell from his glorious position in heaven. But God's not going to just let it go. I think God's going to reclaim it. I know there's some think that actually will be destroyed because it says on Peter, but I think 2 Peter talks about that's a reference, I think, to the tribulation, the fire destruction that Jesus even talked about. He's going to be destroyed, going to baptize the world with fire. Okay, so we're going to keep the world around, not only for a long time, but I think into eternity. It'll certainly be through the millennium, which is just the beginning of the eternal phase, which I don't think there's much difference between the millennium and the second phase of the eternal kingdom. If you look at the differences that are added in the eternal state, as we call it, there are very few. In fact, I'm not sure they are, except that sin is removed. And that's enough for me. Okay, so another way of looking at this, looking at what is the mandate, or is it a curse or a blessing? The conflict with this Satan is most evident in the Christian West, maybe because we live here, yes, and maybe because the West is Christian in a loose sense of the word. So the conflict is most evident in the Christian West's implementation of the Genesis mandate, because, for one thing, Easter religions are already in the tank. They're already in the grip of satanic oppression. They are at ease with the natural cycling, recycling earth, the Earth, the Gaia, as the Mother Earth, who's the caregiver of it all. All this is impersonal, but somehow it is personal, because somehow it acts and does, but how do you describe a God that doesn't exist anyway, but they have this faith in this thing? Well, with her are the pantheon of lesser gods who are inconsequential in daily life. They really don't interfere a lot with you. I was listening to one of the History Channels the other day, and like the History Channel, they were talking about the destruction of Diana in Ephesus. And it's supposedly, I think this probably really happened, the meteor fell out of the sky and crushed her, you know, like, smashed her, or something like it, or close by. Now, we have a god got destroyed by a meteor. Is that kind of a little troublesome if that's your god? Happened to be a goddess. But they explained that, well, this was during the time, I'm not sure I got the right dates or the right people involved here, but it was during the time when Rome was having their fights, and she was away taking care of the wars, and so she wasn't at home in Ephesus, so that's why her... you're supposed to say, oh my, that's about it, oh my. So these pantheons of lesser gods are inconsequential. They can't even protect their own turf. You know, Isaiah makes fun of them. You got to nail them down so they don't topple over, and you got to carry them around if they want to go somewhere. But you never ask them where they want to go, because if you did, they wouldn't tell you. So you have to guess where they want to be. So you put them where they look the best, I guess. Hope it works out. So these are gods that are inconsequential in daily life. Regarding the mandate to subdue, they inspire no one and produce little to nothing, since mystical Eastern religion contemplation is directed inwardly. The mandate is ignored or held in disdain, substituting for it a life of centering in the self. I think they go after the navel. It is only by the grace of God and biology, the guilt God has built into the men and the women, that the next generation exists at all. So I call that common grace, and that produced the next generation. They would die off in their generation. Christians, all form of it, believe in the command to fill the earth with human births and subdue it. That is to utilize the resources of the earth. Christians can harness the earth's natural resources to make humanity flourish and thrive in spite of the hostile fallen environment. And this mandate to subdue is directly connected to a developed knowledge of science. I'll say it here. Maybe I'll forget. Maybe I'll say it again. I forget how I got this. I did this after class. I mean, after I did this. But I think we have two sections in the mandate. We have, I said to you one time, and somebody looked at me a little oddly, and I said, there's really a female aspect of the mandate and a male aspect of the mandate. Remember that I said that? Okay, the female aspect, and somebody said, well, men are involved in procreation too. Yeah, but how much time do you spend at home with the kids? The mother does that, doesn't they? Okay, so she is the fulfill aspect of it, and the subdue is the male aspect of it. And look at how I got this stacked up here. The marriage is the attack of Satan on the mandate, that aspect of it. And on the male aspect of it, it's his work or his workplace or the things that he does, which a lot of it is the environmental things. I want to follow that through a little bit. So on the work side, in order for that to occur, and what the Christian West has done is in the area of science. These navel gazers in the East did not come up with much science. They were busy navel gazing. But the Christians in the West, in what's called the Dark Ages, were not dark at all. Tremendous leaps forward were made by the, quote, then Catholic-type Christian church in the areas of science, how you make things. And this dichotomy is interesting because I remember years ago we were talking to people that were involved in missionary oversight. He said, yeah, well, you don't really like to send the men to the mission field too much because all they want to do is tinker. You know, the women inside, they're either, you know, supposed to do what they're doing, translating the Bible or whatever. The men outside, they're figuring out how they're going to get the water from the well to the house with a bucket on a rope or something, rather than have to carry it. Well, that's men. Men tend to fix things, do things, generate things, create things, make them better. You know, put a roof on the house, make a warmer house, make one with the windows in it. So then we just get into further and further more science because we get into electricity and all this kind of stuff. So we have to have an understanding of science to actually subdue the earth. And how many of you ladies are interested in science? I know there's always the outliers. But most of the gals are really more interested in something else. Leona likes math. You're an unusual person. I mean, because you like math. Because a lot of gals don't like math, don't do well in it. But they do well in the languages. So we have this thing going on, and we shouldn't think that's bad, that we have these special strengths. So all I'm pointing out is here, in the mandate, we have two divisions. So it's a way to look at the mandate, and we watch how Satan attacks, and he attacks at the mandate level. And when he attacks at the mandate level, it has an effect on the economy. Because nothing affects the economy more than marriage. I said early in our lesson, I said, if you'd pick out one thing that you could pick to fix most, that would fix the most, whatever, fix it the most, would be to eliminate single mother births. I said it the other way. I said sex outside of marriage. That's what I said. You do that, and you fix a lots of problem. Well, see, that's fixing a problem that's on the mandate. God says to be fruitful and multiply, not as single mothers, but as solid, stable families with a mother in it, with a father providing. All right, so we have these two pictures. I think that they're men and against women. We're just going to do the feminist aspect of it tonight, tomorrow, because I didn't have time to do the other side. I hope to do that next week. I'm not to it yet, but we'll get to it. Now, the Christian premise, after the fall of pagan Rome, this is still on the science issue, after the fall of pagan Rome, science was the natural outgrowth of Christian doctrine. Why? Nature exists because it was created by God. Science exists because it was created by God. In order to love and honor God, it is necessary to fully appreciate the wonders of His handiwork, and when you do that, you learn about Him. Because God is perfect, His handiwork functions in accord with immutable principles. He's predictable. By the full use of our God-given powers of reason and observation, it ought to be possible to discover these principles we call science and use them. And I think that is subduing the earth. Well, with the breakup of the Roman Empire, Christianity released the tax-paying millions from a paralyzing oppression, which was paganism. Paganism was a paralyzing oppression. Many new technologies began to appear and were rapidly and widely adopted, with the result that ordinary people were able to live better lives. And after centuries of decline under Rome, the population, mothers, began to grow. Human effort and ingenuity turned to better ways to farm, to sail, to transport goods, to build churches, even to make war, to educate, and even play music. They were beginning again to subdue the earth. One of my favorite authors in this area of writing is Rodney Stark. This is from Victory of Reason, How Christianity Led to Freedom, Capitalism, Western Success. Wonderful book. If you have interest in this, read it. I never read much of his stuff. Well, weeks ago, sexual nature of the filling and subduing, as I already talked about, some weeks ago we mentioned casually my observation that filling the earth has feminine overtures and that subduing the earth has masculine overtures. Our further study has borne this to be true. Now, here's my development. While both sexes are involved in both aspects of the mandate, in terms of time spent and interest in the family, the woman spends the most time with the children. Thank you. Whereas the father's involved as a parent, but has his life focused outside the home on the work of creating a better life for the family, utilizing science. This necessitates the utilization of science in subduing the efforts. Does that sound like an echo? So we have these simple things out of Matthew, or out of Genesis, that are so simple. God said, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth, which starts out, add, multiply, and then to the point of fill, subdue it, all inanimate materials, and then how about the animate ones, the fish, the birds, everything living. And I think, by the way, that men and women both rule over the animals. So maybe we share in that aspect of it more equally. So there we have, in a very, very simple statement in the first chapter, I think written by the hand of God himself, and he gave it to Adam, says, here is your job. And this was before the fall. And after the fall, and after the flood, Noah got the same mandate from the Lord again. Fill the earth, subdue it, rule over the fish in the air. I think you missed the last part, but it's obviously implied. All right, so we have no reason to go back on this. No reason to think that this division of labor here, even, is a sinful act. It is how God created us and developed us. And by the way, I thought Gil's job on Sunday nights, 1 Timothy 2, was outstanding. Best I've ever heard him do that. If you didn't hear that, I can't say get the tape because we don't do tapes anymore. So get the whatever. Get it online. Do they do that? You can get that online. Sure you can. Okay, as seen by Satan, it is evident that the fall of Satan occurred after the mandate was given in Genesis. Again, I hear an echo. But with the fall of the angelic world after day 7, could be after day 6, after man was created, in the curse of God, Satan was cast into the realms of the created earth, in other words, the created universe, Isaiah 14:12. Satan chose to live in the realm of what God had created for man. I don't know for sure. You know, I changed the writing on it. I think that God cast him on earth. It's hard to know that maybe that's what he did, but where else was Satan going to go? You know, where else is he going to go? But I think he chose to go to earth because that's where man was. That's what God created, so that's where he chose to go. God said to Satan before man fell, you know, saying, hey, you got something to do this afternoon? Why don't you go down and bug those, you know, humans down there, Adam and Eve, give them some trouble. I don't think God would have said that. I think Satan figured this out himself. So he chose to go down and live in their realm and cause trouble and havoc in God's realm. So Satan chose to live in the realm of what God had created by man, for man. He then turns his full fury on destroying what God had made his crowning achievement, man. So destroying his habitat threatens man's existence. Had some water. One. Okay, so the mandate asking by Satan. If the mandate can be neutralized, Satan thinks, he does think well. If the mandate can be neutralized, thwarted, or otherwise made impossible to achieve, Satan has delivered a fatal blow to God's plan for his creation. Hence, the relentless attack on the duties of man to fulfill and subdue the earth continues. And he's split it up, so we have attacked the woman on her role, and he attacked the man on his turf and his role. So it is pronounced in these last days, so it seems, perhaps because presumptively Satan has run his course, we hope. Maybe it's always been this difficult, but it seemed like in the last, well, frankly, since 1960, with the, what's that period called? Well, the feminism is really what started there, but the change of culture changed in 60. Authority was questioned, and the pill came in and liberated, quote, everybody, except it enslaved everybody. So from that time on, it seemed like there's been an unrelenting attack. And a lot of it has come into the church. That's why Gil did Sunday night what he did with the passage in Timothy, how many pages it takes to undo something, how to undo something that's really quite clear. And that's a good lesson for us when you see somebody putting a lot of pages to a problem, you know he's probably trying to obfuscate. He's trying to change what it really says. So anyway, we have these last days, seems like crescendoing on us. So the battle against the mandate, how is it being engaged in our day? Remember our female-male aspects of the mandate? We're going to start with we're going to do the ladies tonight. I don't pick on ladies. I just think that Satan, if all he needs to do is take care of the female aspect of the mandate, just take care of that. Destroy what they're supposed to do, the game is over. The economy is shot, the children are going to be shot, the next generation is gone. Just do this. Well, what's it going to do? Stop the expansion of the population. How's it going to do that? Abortion. Killing the unborn. How unthinkable. Wow, easy solution. The opposition to the filling mandate is evident in the abortions. If every conception is aborted, there can never be a filling. But, don't get too far ahead of me here, but the abortion rate need not be 100% to destroy the population. It needs only to be less than 2 births per generation. Slow it down. Some parts of, this is not supposed to be funny, some parts of the West have fallen below sustainable rate. Now get this. Japan sells more adult diapers than children's diapers. Not meant to be funny, but the irony is inescapable, and so are the economic implications for the mandate. By the way, I give you a footnote where that's from if you doubt that truth, and you can doubt the source. It was just one I picked. All right. Abortion is one. How about homosexuality? Does that not destroy the family and children? One of the most least productive pairs in the world are homosexuals, couples. I don't care how good the contract is or how much their marriage license costs. Homosexuality is now an acceptable social partnership, pushing to destroy marriage. I think whenever there's a homosexual marriage allowed in a state, marriage has been destroyed. It has not been changed, not been added to. It is absolutely destroyed because you have to ask every time somebody says, well, I'm married, you have to ask, well, who are you married to? Or what kind of sex are you married to? Because it qualifies it. When you have to qualify something, it's destroyed the original. So homosexuality now is an acceptable social pattern, at least not in Nebraska, but in many places, pushing to destroy the marriage. They will not stop until there is no distinction. Homosexual couples add nothing to filling the mandate. Again, even if only a small percentage of the population practice unproductive relationship, it reduces the birth rate by that much. Further in the schools, I gave you an example of my grandson in our famous school down the road here. The class he is, the feminist class that he's in, that's not what it's called, but it's full of feminist ideas, where she said that children ought to be encouraged to evaluate their sexual preferences in the home without the influence of the parents, with the idea that happiness will lead to a great number of in the name of happiness, and this will lead to a greater number of what Bible calls perversions. So you have these children don't know who they are. Well, they might change their mind when they're 8. Well, they might change their mind again when they're 17. Well, it might change. What is going on here? So what it has done is destroyed the reproductive mandate. The mandate killers are accumulative. You know, we got to take the abortion, plus the gay marriage, non-marriage, plus the delay. We're going to get the delay in marriage here, but, you know, this gets accumulated, is what I'm trying to say here. We add more now. Feminism, the whole idea of feminism, denigrates the essential contribution of women for their childbearing, home-building choices. They make them choices, but their mandate. They tend to limit the number of births. That is, they populate the manage the population. We don't hear too much about overpopulation as much now as we did in the 70s because it's been sort of made to be fallacious. The world can handle a lot more people than live on it. Everybody that lives in the world, I told you one time, can live in Texas and live off the land in Texas. Of course, not Texas, pretty big, but, you know, they don't take a very big patch to grow your cucumbers and tomatoes. Okay, so they intend to limit the number of births, population control, and even in some cases, whether a birth will occur via abortion or means of hysterectomy. I have a first cousin who had hysterectomy when she was in her early 20s when she got married because she said, we are not going to have any children. Well, that is, and she's not a believer, in full defiance of having children. Perfect. Fits that exactly. Another person down the road, limiting the amount of children that be born to the world. Now, the ploy offered women is a significant life. Not just a home woman take care of these dirty-faced children with dirty diapers. You got something whole much better to do. I mean, you can be dressed up in a suit all day long and have coffee with a man and go home and to an empty house. Yeah, okay. The offer of ploy, the ploy offered women is a significant life in the male subduing the world role, which necessitates a dual role, which is virtually impossible. How many magazine articles have you read? Women, you read them. Can we have it both ways? Well, the answer usually comes out, well, of course. Or, you know, with, you know, the very few would say, no, you can't. But it really is. The women are the one that pay the price. You know, I've told you before, you want women's liberation, go to, where did I say, Russia. Well, the men don't work and the women do. And they bear the children on top of it yet. So feminist philosophy results in delaying births and a further decline in birth rates. The invention of the pill on the surface liberated the women from childbearing or delayed it. Same thing to some extent. The truth of the revelation is that it liberated the men to get promiscuous sex and relieve them of their subduing work because the women wanted to do it. See, all you got to do is pervert the women. The men don't need to be perverted because it's all over. That's how important a woman's role is in society. So when I talk about them staying home and taking care of the kids, it's not denigrating them. It's putting them in the place that Christianity puts them and where God puts them. I'm glad my mom raised us, although she was a hard worker, with us three boys and no girls. But she was mom at home. More mandate violations. Delay marriage. On average, women are marrying at age 27, 29. And the average age is still climbing due to economic. And I question, what economic reasons are there? Oh, I know, big college debts. For degrees they don't need or will ever use. And these cultural reasons, I don't know. And I say the best years for healthy childbearing are the ones that are behind them at 27, 28. Our oldest, Wanda, was, what are you, 30 when you're your last child? And we had them spaced out, you know, like 4 years. Couldn't handle them that quick. So best childbearing years are behind them. So you get into 30s with number one, and you're 30-something with number one, you'll probably find out that many of these women will never have number two. So then if you just have one, the birth rate drops down to one, not two. Another mandate violation is the decline or delay in marriage. Said 47% of children born today are born to single mothers. I heard that the other day. I said, wow, 40% of all the babies in the United States are born to unwed mothers? And you put the blacks in there, that's in their 70 rates or even higher. And that, I mean, it's horrible. What kind of future do these poor little guys have, girls have, in these kind of homes? And don't tell me they don't have economic implications. They'll never get dug out of a hole. So we turn to our biblical economy. So we have been looking at Bible economics to find again a conflict in the ways of man and the ways of God. Okay, I said this right. Failing the feminine mandate, it destroys entire mandate. In the mandate, we have seen that the Bible holds man responsible and accountable for his conduct. He is unique. He uses self-interest, self-love, to promote a better place for himself, provide a better place for himself and his family. We could even say that he could thrive in spite of the drag of the four judgments. The Bible supports the idea of freedom in the marketplace to set prices and the security of a strong nation for private property ownership. Very essential. We talked about it last two weeks. These factors, freedom to sell, are necessary to set up a win-win situation where virtually everyone wins rather than everybody loses, which is what we're on now. Socialism is where everybody loses. We'll just do a little better next time. But everybody will lose. Well, let's do a little faster. We didn't do enough of it. But everybody will lose. Let's find God would give us a win-win situation. We do not need to focus on the wealth of the middle class. I get so tired of hearing that. I said, every time I hear that, and everybody's doing it, all parties, we got to focus on the middle class. Why? What's going to happen to the underclass? Why don't we just help them all? And you know the win-win situation? Everybody gets helped. I know they're trying to get votes by promoting the middle class because supposedly the middle class people vote, I guess. So we do not need to focus on the wealth of the middle class. Doing so will ignore another class. Okay, so I think it's in the sense of a class warfare, which they say they don't do. So the beauty of a free market economy is that the exchange of private property value can be harnessed into a win-win event for everyone, where no one goes backward, but all advance, even though not at the same rate or with the same outcome. The opportunity to improve relatively for his station exists for all. That's a win-win situation. Man, I call it the managed market or the free market. The Bible, according to man, is that he is not responsible, but that humans, bad luck, cause this environment that he's in. All humans are to have the same privileges and the same outcomes. This equality stuff, this bland milk toast. Never anything too much, because that would be bad, so just enough to get by, make life really boring. He is not accountable, but he is a victim of another's greed. Therefore, he needs protection. This poor fella. He needs protection from the exploiting predators who steal the value of his labor and leaves him robbed of his personal wealth. He would like a better life, but he cannot achieve it because he has been raped by his employer. So we got to have some laws to fix that. That's the managed market. Remember the meter on the board? So last week we talked about private property, and I said, did we stumble on a profound truth? And it seemed like we have, not that we made it up. Why are the underprivileged nation? Okay, we're going to talk about nations here, but it's totally applicable to a family. I could have done from a family to a nation, but I think make it to a nation, it makes it maybe lower, not seem so personal attacks. You know, but just think about how this is in nations. Well, that's how it works actually in families. Why are the undeveloped nations or poor families, why are the underdeveloped nations poor, and why do the billions of dollars in foreign aid not help them? Most everybody agrees it doesn't help them. Well, I guess we didn't send them enough. We never did say, well, we sent them too much. Well, it's once you hear that once in a while from somebody somewhere, some with sane heads. My question is, do they not have freedom and secure private property? The answer is, they do not have freedom and secure private property ownership. That's why it doesn't help. Dollars are no help. It is because it gets funneled to the powerful. Corruption follows the money. Large money equals large corruption. And if the money did get to the poor farmer, it would destroy his economy. An increase of capital without increasing product produces inflation, More dollars chasing the same goods. That's called inflation. By contrast, every square inch of United States, Europe, Japan, and the British colonies, which they controlled much of the world in the 19th century, can be accounted for as being owned by somebody. Not so in the third world. Those dirt poor people have nothing. They own nothing. And by the way, their politics in the third world make it that way. Because guess what? Foreign aid's coming. What? Paychecks. What? Where does it go? Number of accounts in the Swiss banks. Doesn't help the people. And if it did send the money, it's like, it's not a right analogy, but I thought about it. It's like eating, like giving a starving man a lot of food. You'll kill him. Yeah, I mean, the influx of just cash doesn't do anything. Now we have Hernando de Soto. He's a Peruvian economist. Don't know who he is. I got him footnoted down there. Out of the book Poverty of Nations by Grudem. It's a kind of a good book on the nations. Has argued that a formal property system is a key that unlocks the mystery of capital. Or wealth. May I like that word better. He says that this helps explain why capitalism, or free market, has succeeded in the West, but not in many other places. And when I say Christianity and the property rights comes out of the law. In much of the developing world, people may cultivate and live on land they don't clearly own, or own only extra legally. They don't have titles representing their ownership. Legal authorities will honor and accept as binding, thus protecting the wealth spent on its development. You know, I can have a piece of land, I can develop it, I can put crops on it, but if somebody's going to steal it, I'm not going to do it again. Because there's no one going to stop them from doing it. Remember I told you in Ukraine, we were there, the farmers, after the collapse of the Soviet communism, they gave the land back to the people, and everybody got their 35 acres, or whatever it was. But they didn't know where it was. Well, how are you going to find farm 35 acres if you don't know where it is? So they had 35 acres on a piece of paper and said, well, it doesn't do me any good. And Patrick wants to farm a bunch, so he's going on buying all these pieces of paper, and so he's got enough of them, he's going to farm. And I get my $35, $1 an acre, and I'm better off than it was before. And that's how they own property. That's not owning property. That will never get you anywhere, the Ukraine, sorry. And they're in trouble. From the Russian side. As a result, a farmer may toil over the same plot of land for decades, but never get beyond hand-to-mouth subsistence farming, producing just enough to survive and not enough surplus for anyone to be tempted to steal. He learns not to produce too much because it's a waste of his time. The land serves only an immediate physical purpose and never becomes a real, reliable asset. Therefore, the farmer can never exploit, use it to its advantage, potential advantage. He acts for the short term, not for the long term, since it is held informally or extra legally. De Soto called such land dead capital, useless. Does produce nothing, because he can produce just for himself, because if he makes more, somebody's going to take it. No one's going to protect him from taking it. His research team has calculated that the total value of real estate held by non-legally owned, but legal real estate held but not legally owned by the poor of the third world and former communist nations is at least $9 trillion. Presumptively, this is land that can be utilized to subdue the earth by its raising the standard of living. But since they can't own the land, it will never happen. That's vastly more than all the foreign aid ever given to these countries. Much to little effect. Third world people may have houses but no titles, crops but no deeds, businesses but no statutes of incorporation. But they may not have these tomorrow. So you can't build it tomorrow. Of course, formal freedom and private property ownership is not the magic bullet for all the world's ills. But it is the beginning, the first rung of the ladder. But even then, it needs the moral underpinning of Christianity, double word there, to succeed. I've read my book by Grudem. I like the book, believers that write it. And this is a book written to the nations, the poverty of nations, and how they can rectified their problems. Some things I just read to you, you know, give the ownership to the people and so forth. But when all said and done, I got thinking, people can read this stuff, but if you don't have a Christian understanding of how things are with the love for your brother that you won't rob from him, how is this ever going to get implemented? So I think they're whistling in the dark because no one's going to read, they'll read the book and say, well, I like my foreign aid income, so I'm not going to do this. There may be a few guys that might say, well, let's try this. They love their country and their people that much. They might do that for them, but they'd be in such a minority, it'll never happen. So we go on this misery. Misery breeds misery and breeds misery. Okay, so what is the magic bullet? What did I say here? If private property ownership in a free market, if private ownership in a free market economy is not the magic bullet, what is? And the class said, creating wealth. I put it up there. Creating wealth is the magic bullet. Now, it doesn't take care of the moral issue. I understand that. Okay, but you can create wealth only in a free market, secured property economy. So that's why the first one's a bottom rung, the next one's the next run up. So creating wealth is not just rearranging wealth that exists. For example, it is not amassing wealth in your portfolio. If I have a bigger portfolio this year than last year, I may not have created $1 of wealth. I may have taken it from somebody else. Now, there is a little bit aspect in there where values of stocks do appreciate and they gain value. I give you that when everybody had their little dollar gift, you know, when they were all said and done, everybody that put a number to how much they liked their gift went up as they traded more and more. In the last, when they could trade everybody with everybody, they liked their gift the best. So there's value added in trading. So I'm going to allow that. But generally, when you just move money around, it doesn't create it. It just, that's what they are. So creating wealth is not moving money from one person to another via gifts, charity, thefts, extortion, taxes, or inheritance. You're just moving around. It is not making somebody wealthy who was poor. Winning the lottery will not create wealth. You may be wealthy, but you did not create wealth. It has nothing to do with how wealth is acquired. Now, example, for the Spaniards who took the gold from the Incas in Mexico, and the bank robbers who takes money from the bank, both have become wealthy if they get away with it, but neither of them made any wealth. In a short time, they will run out of other people's wealth, which they stole. Their system could not be sustained without a supply of other people's money. Got to go rob another bank. They just took existing wealth and transferred it to their bank account, if they got away with it. Now, the war did not create wealth. War on poverty, talking 1964. The war on poverty did not create wealth. It had a zero-sum effect at best. And really, it really was a lose-lose effect when all dollars were counted that were borrowed and shifted. The economic pie was not made larger in the war on poverty, but in fact, it was made smaller. The pieces might have been a little bit resized. The practice took money from one sector, that is the private, and borrowed it, of the economy and transferred it to another sector, then charged, and the government does this, charged a substantial handling fee. Because all the overhead handling, it costs money to pay for the folks that do the work, qualify the transfers, get paid retirement, health benefits, on. So there's no creation of even $1 in wealth when it comes to the war on poverty. And you can read all over the paper how much of a failure it has been. In fact, here's your chart. You see where the arrow shows? It says the war on poverty began. See how the poverty rate was falling until the war on poverty began. What happens if you do something that interferes with the system? It does the exact opposite. So rather than poverty going away, it's been sustained. And this is just up to 2007. Okay. So economic freedom and government forced economic equality are opposing goals. When government forces economic equality, for example, through heavy taxes on the rich, it can actually diminish economic incentives and harm the gross domestic product, which is what I'm talking about there, creating wealth. That's how gross domestic product is achieved. I'll show you how that's done in a minute. This can be seen in history, even this can be seen in history of every nation ruled by communism, whether in the former Soviet Union, Cuba, North Korea, China, before it implemented many free market reforms. Now, I told you about China and the beginning to do that with watermelons in 1983. Wrong goals, equality and sameness, making equality a more important goal than overall economic growth. Got that choice? May I read that again? Making equality a more important goal than overall economic growth is a mistake for a government, because merely distributing the same amount of wealth in different ways does not change the total amount of wealth a nation produces every year, which is the only way that a nation has grown from poverty to prosperity. Again, citing Grudem, Poverty of Nations. What is creating wealth? Not adjusting wealth that already exists. A nation must produce wealth before it can distribute and enjoy it. If they need to distribute it, I'm sure there will be some in some sense. There always has to be taxes. Like to say, we have to have that because it has to be there to protect the assets that are owned privately. So the goal must be to increase the nation's gross domestic product. We have the bottom. I'm running out of time. We have the bottom free market aspect of it. Now we've just added, we are referring to an amazing process by which human beings are able to better their economic situation by making valuable things that did not exist before. Valuable things, not junky watercolors, but valuable things that somebody else besides your mother will buy. That's the principle. So we do this when they do this, they add not only to their own wealth, but also to the wealth of the nation. They do this not by taking something of value from someone else, which would not increase total gross domestic product, that's called stealing, but by making new products or services that no one ever had because they previously did not exist. Well, I want you to meet Aldo Waldo here. He's our Swiss Alp hiker. Aldo lives in a mountain village, happens to be in Switzerland. He sees a lot of hikers walk by his property following a local mountain trail. Aldo notices that some have walking sticks that are made of tree branches. Some are big and fat, heavy. Some are rough and small and break. All serve the purpose, but not very, very well or very attractively. As he observes, he thought about making walking sticks and selling them to the hikers. Aldo watches what hikers use and visits local milling operations. He finds that he can make walking sticks cut to length and diameter. He can also have comfortable hand grips carved in them. And they can be purchased in quantities of 100 for $2 a piece. Aldo also saw himself as an artiste. So he decided that he could paint these walking sticks with designs and patterns that would make each one of them desirable and more unique. So he and his wife thought that they could paint 20 walking sticks a day. That's 15 hours a day each. It takes 1.5 hours to decorate each walking stick. The paint could cost no more than 25 cents for each stick. They'll tie a leather strap to the top handle and make it more attractive and useful. For another 75 cents, total cost of materials would be $3, not counting his labor, which he doesn't need to count yet. So Aldo checks outdoor catalogs and finds that most walking sticks cost between $10 and $75, depending on the decorations and so forth, probably the kind of wood that's made out of. So he makes a judgment that if he were a customer, that the ones that would cost $20 would be the ones he would buy. So he sets an average price, $20 per stick, and makes some as plain for $10 and buys, sets the price for the more decorative ones higher. So he figures this works. So he buys 100 sticks, decorates them, sells them in one summer. So we do the accounting, we find that we have an initial cost of $500. He sold them all for $20 average, so that was $2,000. He made a net profit of $1,500. How much wealth did he create? $1,500. It's just like out of nowhere. Absolutely out of nowhere. It just showed up. That's why the word create works here. You can't use create to make the... He didn't create walking sticks. He made those. So in some sense, I've got to be careful how far I'm going to go with this, but I have never said that man could create because that's the quality that God has. But all of a sudden, here is something that God in his image has given man, and has built man in his image, that he can actually create something. Something exists that did not exist before, out of nothing. And you know what? That is what's measured. in each government to produce the value of the gross domestic product, the GDP. All right, so we have a net gain of $1,500. This represents created wealth, now part of the domestic gross domestic product of Switzerland. Now, you can do services, too. They don't have to be just things. You know, it costs me so much as architectural practice. We cost so much to put out a set of drawings. Well, we got so much for doing it. So what was left was part of our gross domestic product. It was added to our wealth. I'm sure they took it off the income tax and it added them all up. Or somehow they do that. Is that how they do that? I suppose they'd look at your income tax. How much did he make? Whatever. So when all the things people make, services they provide and so forth, for which people will pay good money, the margin between the cost of it and the sold price of it created wealth. It comes out of nothing. Creation is correct here. The aggregate of the sales, less costs, for the nation's population, workforce, is the domestic, gross domestic product. Things that are made but are not counted, we think that I have to be a bunch of those. Well, my wife breaks bread. That doesn't get counted because it does not get sold. But is it a value? Yes, it is. It just doesn't get counted. See, I don't want to diminish that value. It just doesn't get counted in the GDP. So whatever you do at home, you paint your room, and it's, you know, you spend so much better in the room or your house, or whatever is worth so much more. You've actually added to your wealth, but it doesn't get counted in the GDP. So understand that. So what happens when a nation does not make anything that they can sell? What kind of economy will they have? Well, in Hungary, after communism, and we were there, Budapest, was and is in that state. They used to make buses, you know, street buses. But with the event of communism, the buses were so poorly made, no one wanted to buy them. The economy absolutely collapsed. When we were there, what year was that? 2003? 2001, whatever. They said, our guide tool is Hungary produces nothing. We build nothing that some other nation wants. Are they going to be successful? No. It's horrible to think about that. You mean they can't? See, that's what communism does to people. It just destroys them. It absolutely destroys their thinking, their ability, their motivation, how to do things. Well, the same was true in the Ukraine. They built this little car, the Zaporozhye. Zaporozhye is a town. Zaporozhye is where they was made, and we were there. They were making fun of the Zaporozhye. It was a funny car, junky little car. It was a joke in their own home. Remember the Yugo from Yugoslavia? Yeah. Yeah. See many of those around anymore? So without gross domestic product, what will support any standard of living? What happens in an economy when the GDP is so low or too low to sustain the standard of living? It's going to go down. What happens when boatloads of foreign aid in raw dollars are given? What happens to the standard of living in the aggregate? It will go down. In any case, the rich connected have access to the incoming aid, easily help themselves, while the poor never see any. And if it did come in any case, it would be inflationary because just more dollars chasing the same products is inflationary. So to raise the standard of living, more products must be made and sold and purchased. Thus, more wealth is created. All share in a win-win economy. All living standards rise. What happens to the same economy? All the people were given cash to buy things. I always thought about the minimum wage. Why set it at $10? Why not 50? Why not 50? Well, you say, well, that's just, why is it too much? If $10 works, 50 should work better. Using the system. So what happens when the same to the same economy if all people were given cash to buy things? If you all were given 25% of your salary, whatever your income is, and next year or tomorrow you had 25% more of that, nothing has changed out of the marketplace, you just got more money, what's going to happen to the washing machines that are out there?
Inflation.
You're going to probably be at least 25% higher. All right, got the point. So it will go, inflation, the price of those washing machines will go up, or walking sticks, whatever you're selling. If this is maybe a touchy subject. If the government grants cheap loans to college students to incentivize them to go to college, the school, what will happen to the cost of the education? It will go up. I have go up, go down, stay the same. I figured you don't have to even answer that one. By the way, who is benefited by this? Is the college benefited by it? You said yes? A little bit, maybe. For a short time. Until what? Students don't come anymore. I can't go to college. I can't afford that kind of tuition. I'm not going to borrow that kind of money. Maybe got some bright kids that should go to school there that can't work with their hands or whatever it is. So who is benefit? Who is harmed? Well, how the school benefited if no one can afford tuition? How is the student benefited if he has huge debts at graduation but no job, which is the condition we have today? If the minimum wage is set at $30 an hour, what would happen to the cost of groceries at the local store? Go up, wouldn't it? Who is the benefited then? Who is harmed? Well, who is harmed is the little guy again. The store profits a short time but loses business when the poor people no longer can afford to buy his groceries. So again, a lose-lose situation. Tools to think with. The world's a tough place that will demand our undivided attention. I don't mean in spiritual sense now. We've got to, that's a compartment that rides over this. Hard work will be necessary to provide food, clothing, and shelter. I do this in keeping with personal responsibility to act in self-interest for me and my family. For the nation and the families to thrive, there must be freedom to own property and free market to buy and sell what I have made or what I can produce. The only regulation necessary is to protect the private property from theft and extortion. For this, I expect to pay taxes that support that system, that protects its people and the property from depreciation. I must apply due diligence in fulfilling the mandate in protection of marriage, raise a family, work to produce saleable goods, contribute to my country, the larger family, and innovate to raise the standard of living. Now, this is from it's called the Black Book, and I can give the whole title, but anyway, from a Jewish writer. I was amazed at how lucid some unbelievers are when it comes to these kind of things. I have made my comparison with health. Unbelievers and believers alike generally deal with health in the same way, don't you? I mean, some say, oh, I don't go to a Christian doctor, but you don't really mean that, do you? I mean, you want to go to a doctor who can treat you. So when it comes to health issues, we pretty well are on the same level. I mean, we all want our hearts to beat. We all want to live to be at least 110 and want to be healthy all the way and drop dead. We want all to be perfect. So the unbeliever and the believer share something here. I think in the area of economy, the unbeliever who is not tainted by false delusions basically follow this idea because that's how we're built. We're built in a certain way that our bodies function. We're built in a certain way that we should function socially. I don't care what they do with the homosexual stuff, the men and women are still going to grow up to be men and women. There's going to be the outliers, there'll be something else. I feel sorry for them, they've been perverted, but men are men, women are women. Never going to have to tell them. Now make sure you find yourself a husband or it's not going to need to be done. It will go on. God will see to it. It's part of common grace. All right, so this guy says about the condition of our economy or our life or life as we live it now from a real world viewpoint. First is to understand that there is no solution to the dilemmas of the human condition. Does that sound Christian? There's no dilemma to the human condition. Now we say there's salvation in Christ. But in terms of our economy, our social life, there's no solution. This is the fallen world we live in. Second, he says, understand that to escape these dilemmas, human beings will inevitably embark on desperate quests for redemption in this life. What did I say? They try anything to nullify the judgment. These redemptions, these saviors, in return, will require holy wars to purge the worlds of demons, which is inequality, of those who do not share their faith, and who stand in the way. I mean, it's just like, just change a few words here, and Christians could totally agree with this. In this regard, totalitarianism, Islam, is really no different in the heart from totalitarian socialism or progressivism. Even though the latter are secular, the former is pursued in the name of a vengeful malignant, the right word? God. All right. Now, it goes on. Both seek to cleanse mankind of its irreparable imperfections. To remain free beings, we Christians, we are continually forced to defend ourselves and our breathing space against the efforts of the redeemers to perfect us. Remember, we're not the perfect ones. They are. Against the armies of the false saints, who are determined to make the world a better place than it could ever be. That is how I see the political war, and I say against God, because that's really where the war is. It's a political war we face, and we will never end it. And I think that's pretty much what we've got to say about the war with the devil and his attacks on the mandate. It will never end. So we finish. This unbelieving Jew writer lives in the real world and can see what many cannot. But for Christians, as he expresses similar truth in similar words, we know where the real battle is. It is not between people or parties, but between the Creator God and his created angelic being called Satan. Satan is set to destroy everything God has made. It is in his attack on the mandate that he is having a measure of success today. Then we have this last verse, which I think nails it. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces. In his darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. And that's where the battle goes on. And it spills out into us. I sometimes ask the question, just what kind of power does Satan have in this world? Can Satan cause a tree to fall in front of your car and you run into it? I don't think so. I think what Satan's power is, he can get in the minds of people. And in the minds of people, he uses those people, like not necessarily possession, but he controls those people to do his will. So if we can get them out of our mind, we'll get them out of our life. And of course, that's what we have as believers. We have that assurance that he cannot invade our mind. But the world is occupied by they are occupied by those thoughts that are destructive, and they all come from Satan. So there are spiritually devised plans in another world that they filter into our world as Satan has access to those unbelievers that allow him in. Okay, I'm not going to take questions. I'm going to pray. If you got something to say to me, be sure to come up here and do that. Lord, thank you for the evening and again for the joy we have, knowing that you are in control of even every small detail of life, even in the area of economics and how our nations function. Lord, we realize that you intended for humanity to be on earth to thrive and to enjoy and to appreciate all the things you do, whether it's food or whether it's the sunlight or whatever it is, Lord. You've given it all for us to enjoy. And we do very much so enjoy that. And you've given us families. You've given us children. You've given us jobs and things to do to make life better in face of the judgments we live under. But Lord, we realize that all this is something that will never be won, a battle that will never be won, because Satan will never go away. He never sleeps. He never slumbers. And so we must be alert all the time to his devices. Again, thank you, Lord, for the truths of the Scripture that guide our minds and our thinking. We know, Lord, that without the light of the Word, that we would be as lost as anybody else. So thank you, Lord, for that truth and for the gospel that's in Jesus Christ, who died on the cross for us, that we might have life. And that life has already begun in our very daily walk in this world. Dismiss us now as we go to our home. Keep us safe as we go, and bring us back in next week. Pray all in Jesus' name. Amen.